step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
This is the Page Publishing Book Club. How you doing? I'm Alice Stockton Rossini. You know what? We've talked a lot on this show about writing from what you know. And the truth is, we all have different experiences to draw on, right? Some people have led a life we can't even imagine. One that gives them a deep well, so to speak, to draw on. Well, David Lee is one of those people. He's an engineer in Sonoma County now, but before that, he had a fascinating and extremely dangerous job with the military on which he based his book, Primrose Courier. Tell us what you did, David.
Well, I started off as a computer programmer, but then I transitioned into the courier ship, which is handling top secret information and providing that information directly to the special forces teams so that no information is being broadcast over the telephone or satellite phones or anything like that.
So I would think that would inspire many stories, many missions.
Yeah, it's nice because I can take composite pieces of the many missions and make fictitious ones for the book, which is what I did. And my goal was to actually make something similar to the writings of Clancy when he wrote Red October. So when that movie was made, the first couple of minutes of it, it's talking about, you know, events, and then it said, but these never happened. So it gives you the idea, okay, this is like the old training mission quotes, you know, that events happened, but they're quiet and hushed. So I wanted to give that feel to the book.
Do you always feel like you have to protect yourself? You have to be on guard?
For many years after I left the military, you could not even Google my name. Yeah, you couldn't find any information out about me. As a matter of fact, I think around 5 years ago, I took a part-time job as a security specialist and chauffeur. And the company tried doing a background check on me and could not. They couldn't find any information.
And you use a different name.
I did. I used many aliases. So I kept a low profile. And it's been long enough, I imagine, anybody that knew of my presence when I was a courier has been, you know, long gone by now.
So what's the story?
Well, the inspiration was through my best friend of over 35 years. And it was originally a short story. And then as I wrote, it grew into a novel. And I incorporated lyrics to some of the songs that I actually wrote over the years into the book. I kind of weaved it into the storyline. The premise of the story is there's two best friends, and one goes into the military. When he becomes a courier, and you usually have to detach yourself from friends and family, and he does, but his cover gets blown. And when it does, there are other mysteries that start to unravel in the story. And that's how the short story actually grew into the novel. Then the action really starts taking place. I take the main character, or one of the main characters, through his boot camp, and then how he got into his job in the military and how he transitions into the courier ship, and that's when some of the danger starts. And then there's a few missions that were loosely based on some of the things I did in the military. But I'll give you an example of one of the fight scenes that was based on a real event that happened in Germany. The fight scene in the book is with the courier who was supposed to meet his handler, but his handler isn't in this bar where they're supposed to meet. Instead, there are enemies in that bar that did something with the handler, and there's a fight scene that occurs, and the main character, Mitchell, ends up escaping, not completely unscathed, but he has a few wounds, and then at that point in time, he realizes that his cover has been blown.
I take it this is a cliffhanger?
It is a cliffhanger, yes, unfortunately for readers. it's going to be a series. And I'm even considering a what you might call a prequel to the series. Yeah.
Yeah, and with music to boot, here's a little clip from David's song, Invisible to the Blind.
When I look into those mesmerizing eyes, I can't help but see creation that's sublime. Tell me what you see looking back into mine. Are you too afraid to see the shining high?
Hey! All right, David, thank you so much. Writing since grade school, Dana Peters longed for the day she could write full-time and work part-time, and she found the right balance when she moved to New Hampshire and published One Week.
Actually, before I went into retail for 20 years, I worked in the hotel industry on the front desk and reservations and management and such, and I met so many interesting people, and seriously, one night, one of my regular hotel guests came in. I'd known this guest for a long time, but there was something about him that just caught my attention that night, and I came home and started to write. The funny thing is that the story that came out of this guy, the character, the main character, is nothing like the guest. My character is a professional assassin, and I'm pretty sure my hotel guest was not. However, one never knows. So One Week is the title, and it's about a professional assassin who checks into a hotel under a very unassuming name to do a job. He's there to kill a bad guy who sells corporate secrets. And when he arrives at the hotel and such, he meets the front desk clerk, who was not me, because this character, Amy, she's very smart, she's feisty, very beautiful, and she also has her own colorful background. But it's about the two of them, and he is not looking for a relationship or love, but he ends up rescuing Amy when she finds herself in the wrong place at the wrong time, and the attraction was already immediate. And one thing led to another, and now she's got to deal with the fact that she knows he's a professional assassin, and how do you deal with that? There is a second book. It's not a sequel, but the characters show up again. Because again, the main character in One Week, Rick Adams, that's a very unassuming name. So that's not actually his real name. So he's actually popped up in the second book and my third book.
He's in a number of books, but the stories are different.
Yes. And his name is different, which is what I love. I can use this guy over and over and over again.
What's interesting to me is, like, what was it about this guy, this real guy that you saw in the hotel that made you think, you know, assassin?
Well, he, very tall, dark, almost black hair, kind of shoulder length, very dark eyes. The classic 5 o'clock shadow that looked really good on him. Solid built guy. He was friendly, but not, you couldn't really approach him. There was a little bit of a wall, you know. He was very careful about what he said, you know, what he shared. So he had that mysterious aspect to him. But he was very friendly, very polite. But I have to say, though, very quickly, so Rick Adams in the book, he's not really the real guy, because I'm hoping the real guy isn't a professional assassin.
Yeah, wouldn't that be funny, huh?
Wouldn't that? The book came out in 2015 in October, and I left for a month in November and went to Australia and actually sold quite a few copies over there.
How did you sell quite a few copies in Australia?
Just talking to the people that I met. I went to go horseback riding in the mountains, and I met this fabulous group of people, fabulous group of women, and this is a romantic thriller, so it intrigued them. And they've all bought a copy. And then I was traveling around visiting other friends and just talked about it to everybody and found out a bunch of people bought it. It was so fun. I've spoken to some women's groups. We did do the book signing at Innisfree, which also included other local authors, because they do a fabulous local authors day, or they did before COVID. So that was really fun. Also, too, working in the hotel that I was working at, my hotel guests bought the book, and the manager of the hotel joked with me that, you know, in a hotel room, you have Gideon's Bible in the one drawer. Well, we wanted to put my book in the other drawer. A lot of my other hotel guests have bought it and have been following me, and because I do have a website, mountaintopwriternh.com. And I keep in touch with a lot of my hotel guests, even though I left the hotel business. I keep in touch with them. And what probably was one of the most fun things was one of my guests, he called me. He wanted to give my book to his wife for Christmas, which I thought was so fun. So I have a lot of personal contact with my readers, which I absolutely love.
Well, that's the way to do it, Dana. Good for you. Peter Brennan is a retired telecommunications engineer in Palm Harbor, Florida. Sailing is his passion, and he's got some stories to tell in his book, Fun with Sailboats. Now, you started with stories from when you were what, 13?
Yes. The main gist, when I actually sat down and wrote it as a book, is it really struck me that there are a lot of books about sailing, about people who are extremely extreme. People like Ernest Shackleton that, you know, sail to Antarctica and get caught in ice. Or people that, you know, quit their jobs, sell their house, and do nothing but sail. And my thought was, just somebody who's got a regular daytime job and a family, that's a totally different kind of person. And then there's a lot more of those people, and the kind of people that are going to sell a house and quit their job and go off sailing. But we like sailing too. And it struck me after several years of doing it that you could have tremendous fun and do a lot of really great adventurous things without kind of giving up a normal life to do it. One that really struck me was during the Round Ireland sailing race in 2018, and it was about halfway through the race, and we were off the west coast of Ireland in the Atlantic Ocean by Skellig Michael and some, you know, famous places. It was an old wooden sailboat that I was crewing on, and we were surrounded by a pod of whales. And I thought to myself, if somebody had come to me when I was 16 years old and reading The Lord of the Rings and daydreaming and said, when you're older and in your 50s, you'll be in this situation, I would have thought, no, that couldn't happen. So that was a highlight. But that is what sort of made me think, gosh, how did I come from just a little tiny bit of sailing to doing these major sailing things? And I wanted to express to people that if you think you can, you probably can. You don't have to be a millionaire. You know, you don't have to stop doing everything else in your life to do sailing. You can really have that kind of fun just as a normal person.
It's not cheap. I mean, to buy a sailboat.
Well, that's another point, though. I never spent more than $10,000 on a boat. The boat that I did most of my sailing on was an older boat. It was in good condition, but I bought it for $4,000. It was a 1971 30-foot Pearson sailboat, and I sailed that to Block Island from Oyster Bay and back every year for 7 years, and sailed, you know, all from like April to November. I lived up in Long Island at that time, sailed around Long Island in the Around Long Island Regatta, and then Martha's Vineyard and Block Island and New York Harbor, you know, and all of that. And it really was not that expensive. Another point is, once you're a pretty good sailor, people need you as crew. I mean, at the moment, I don't own a sailboat. I just crew. And, you know, now that I'm pretty good at sailing, I remember when I had a boat, I was always looking for crew. So it doesn't have to be as expensive as you might think it would be.
Did your whole family do it with you?
They did when they were young. My kids are grown and gone now with kids of their own. But I was lucky enough I had that boat while they were young and at home, and we would sail all summer and into the fall. I did sailing with my family, and then I also did sailing with my friends. I kind of did both. One time we were sailing from St. Pete, Florida, Isla Mujeres, Mexico, and we left somebody at the helm who, in retrospect, we shouldn't have. And he nearly got us run over by a freighter. And that was a very frightening thing. The amazing thing is the guy who owned that boat, he had already been hit by a freighter on another occasion. And miraculously, nobody was killed. So, yeah, you do have to take it seriously. I do have a Facebook page. The book is called Fun with Sailboats. So anybody could look up the Facebook page, Fun with Sailboats. And I post, you know, photos, sometimes videos, you know, about different places I've been, places people might like to sail to.
All right, Peter, thank you. We're going to take a quick break. This is the Page Publishing Book Club. We'll be back right after this.
Attention all authors. Page Publishing is looking for authors. Have you written a book and want to get it published? Page Publishing will get your book into bookstores and for sale online at Amazon, Apple, iTunes, and other outlets. They handle all aspects of the publishing process for you. Printing, cover art, publicity, copyright, and editing. Call 800-204-6099 now for your free author submission kit. That's 800-204-6099 for your free author submission kit.
And we're back on the Page Publishing Book Club. I'm Alice Stockton-Rossini. Norman Rose is a chiropractor in Goshen, Indiana, and it's no secret the profession still gets a bad rap in the medical community, and making things worse are chiropractors who have no business being chiropractors. So Norman wrote a book that'll help you tell the difference. It's entitled Saints or Quacks.
I'm 81 years old. I've been at this for 54 years in active practice. So I've seen a lot of people, and when you go to the chiropractor today, it's pretty expensive. And after 2 years of practice, I started adjusting people at a low fee. I went to the Better Business Bureau and found out what the average working man's wage was. And I decided to charge my fee at that. And if the chiropractor does a good job, you're going to get good results. So we started seeing a lot of people. And we wound up, over that 47-year period, we saw over 200,000 people come through our office. That's almost 30% of our area. When I came there, there were only 7 chiropractors in the area. Right now, we have over 70 chiropractors in the area. We've kept the fees low so that the average person can come in and get an adjustment. And the rest of them, the rest of the chiropractors who've come into the area have had to follow our template. And they charge less. So that's why our area is very inundated with chiropractic care.
You said saints are quacks. Are you advising people how to tell a good chiropractor from a bad chiropractor?
Yes, indeed.
Okay. I had hurt my back working out. And this friend of mine said, oh, I have my husband's a chiropractor. And I went in to see him. He would not treat me until I signed up for a series of chiropractic treatments over the course of a year, like a gym membership, he kept saying. And I was like, oh my God, I'm sitting on this table. Can you please just help me? Like, I don't know if I want to sign up for a whole year. You know, I don't know if I want to go to a chiropractor every week, you know, for the rest of my life. Like, just, are you going to help me? And it was really a horrible experience. I would say that guy was a quack. No.
Yep. That's, and see, that's what I'm opposed to. Our schools are allowing that type of activity to take place. And that's what I've got the theme, the golden thread all through this book, is that what we're doing is we're allowing those type of chiropractors to exist in the profession today. And what they are doing, they're destroying everybody else's opportunity to go to the chiropractor. We're only seeing 5% of the population. We should be seeing 95% of the population. We should be setting ourselves up like the second chiropractor, somebody that you can go to and have a good experience with at a price that you can afford and get in and get out and be on your way. We adjusted you just like you. You went in, you had a problem. We got rid of that problem in 2, 3, 4 adjustments, and you were on your way and you were excited. Our profession is being led by people who are allowing this type of activity to take place. And I'm totally opposed to it. And that's what the theme and the thread through this book is, that the American people are getting ripped off by those type of chiropractors and the profession itself allowing that type of stuff to take place. People should be damn mad at the chiropractic profession for not allowing them to go to a chiropractor to be able to get in.
So there's a copy of your book in the office, I suspect, right?
Yes, right. We're going to get a lot of support. I think once we get it out and get it under the door of a lot of places, yes, I think it'll be a very popular item, because there are polls out there that say 70% of the people would like to go to have an adjustment if they could afford it or have the door open so that they could get in and get it. Now, most of the chiropractors, if they do have a book out there, they're trying to sell what we are describing as we don't want.
All right, Norman, thanks for the heads up. Brian Bett is an aspiring musician in LA. He plays guitar, sings, drives Uber to make ends meet. He started writing stories for his older brother when he was about 4 and kept it up right through high school. Years later, a companion challenged him to prove his writing prowess, and Destiny of Silence was born.
My fiance at the time, we were driving a truck. I was an over-the-road trucker, and I told her about my stories, and she asked me to write her one. So I wrote her one chapter, and then when she got done, she's like, more. And I wrote her another one, and then I wrote her another one for about a week. I was writing her a chapter every single day. And then right about then, I started, for lack of a better phrase, losing my train of thought for the story as to where it was going to go. It started out as just medieval, and I based the characters on me, her, and my brother and my sister. So they're actually my whole family in the book. It starts out with a king that has twin sons. And instead of watching them fight over the throne, he just basically splits the kingdom into two. And then he ends up dying. And that's when the evil brother, now they're not identical twins, and he's a little bit more pushy, and he believes he has right to both kingdoms. But because they were born pretty much the exact same time, all the rules says, no, you can't, if there's, you know, twins. And then he tries to take over the kingdom. He ends up killing the other king. But Sherrod, the good king, ends up having a son. He gets married. And then when he has the son, he ends up getting assassinated. And the heroes, Daemon, Sharia, they end up taking the boy and the queen, because they made it look like they killed everybody when they took over the castle. So they took the boy off. And basically, the name Destiny of Silence, it ends up being like the kid can't say anything. Like, nobody can say anything about him. He can't tell him, hey, I'm the king, where they have to hide him. And his destiny basically becomes silence. That's where the name Destiny of Silence comes from.
So you went from writing a chapter a day or a week for this woman to a 4-part series we have now?
Yeah, it's when I got to the end of that week, we ended up getting so busy on the truck. We had load after load after load. I didn't have time to actually sit in the back. We were actually kind of on a furlough at the time I was writing, because I was driving for about 10 hours a day. And then it kind of went back to about 8 hours a day. And that's why I had an extra little bit of time. But I ended the story because I was going to finish it. I was going to make it a lot longer, but I talked to a bunch of people and they all said, I don't like reading long books. So I figured if I wrote a book that was 30 chapters, it may not be as interesting as a 2-hour movie, because I'm a big movie buff. And that's kind of where I got the idea. The book reads like a 2-hour movie. It's 5 chapters long. And then at the end, it's kind of like Lord of the Rings. You get to the end of, you know, the first movie and you're like, hey, what the heck? And then you got to go to part 2, and then at the end of part 2, it's like, come on. But the movies are not as long as the books. They have most of the stuff that's in the books, but not nearly as much.
Okay. So, I mean, you're an Uber driver. You could sell this book to every customer you pick up.
Well, I don't actually drive for the customers. Like, I don't pick up people and take them. I just do the food delivery. So in passing, when they see the book on the seat, because I leave the book on the seat, and they ask about it. When they ask about it, I tell them about it.
All right, Brian, that's one way to go. Thank you. A data analyst for the Department of Defense, James Dillon has been writing every night for years, compiling historic and scientific evidence that would support the viability of the biblical story. But as he did his research, he became fascinated by the why behind certain events. The name of his book, The Odds of Being Jesus.
So just imagine having an itch. You just have to scratch, that you have that compulsion that can only be satisfied through action. In my case, I don't want to minimize it by saying it was an intellectual itch, but I had this compulsion that the only way that I could really find happiness, I guess, was through the writing of this. I've obviously had times of happiness, of course, you know, getting married, birth of my son. You know, and now anytime my son stops a shot as a goalkeeper, I get little periods of joy. But there's no level of contentment that I've found when I was writing this. Just being able to understand just how God orchestrated the plan of our salvation. Kind of looking at not just the ends of that salvation, but how each aspect of it provided means that had huge lessons for us along the way. So that's why I say it wasn't exactly peaceful. It was just that compulsion that really kept driving. It's like I wanted to learn more. I wanted to share more type of thing each night. It runs through a couple dozen of the messianic prophecies that basically provides kind of in different aspects. It'll present some of the art, like I say, the archaeology. Sometimes it's math. Sometimes it's even geology and astronomy to bring out certain events, certain things that were happening around the time. So that in doing so, and I tried to use language that was vivid, to say the least. It was meant to be just everyday language written in everyday ways to try to bring the past alive. You know, 2,000 years ago, what was going on, to better understand what was going on, you know, why that that particular messianic prophecy was prophesized and then came about the way it did and the lessons involved in there. My favorite word, I have to be honest now, in the entire Bible is now the word tetelestai. I bet 99.99% of people have never heard of it, never would hear of that word. But when it's translated in English, it means it is finished. And so, well, that's great. That's one of the last sayings that Jesus said on the cross. Obviously, it would be important if you're in the middle of crucifixion, what are those last, you know, vital things you want to share? So to say something like it is finished, you know, okay, well, what is the finished? So when I got into studying the actual verbiage, the actual language, you find out, well, that in the Greek, the word finished is in a weird tense called present perfect, which means it's not just done now. It means it's done now and forever will remain so. So, okay, that's great. That's the finished. What's the it part? What was Jesus trying to convey as the it part? So did more research on that side. And you go back, had to go back to the Sermon on the Mount, basically where Jesus said he wasn't there to abolish the Old Testament law, the Old Covenant law. He was there to fulfill. That's what he was there to accomplish. That was the it. And again, going back to the translations from another Greek term, that accomplished really was not just doing something, it was actually transitioning something to a new reality. So a little word like tetelestai in Greek, as it's in the Bible, or, you know, it is finished, really was a way of declaring, you know, the old covenant is now completely and fully transitioned to the new covenant and forever will remain so, which had so many profound aspects to it that I'd never realized it that before. I like many Christians, have heard, okay, it is finished, and never really thought about it. So when I really got into it, discovered, wow, that there's just so much more meaning than I ever would have imagined.
All right, James, leaving us with some food for thought as we close out this edition of the Page Publishing Book Club. Thanks to our authors for sharing their stories, as always. And tell your writer wannabe friends to download the podcast at 710WOR.com. I'm Alice Stockton-Rossini. I'll catch you next time.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.